it, providing it some of its funding, can go back and sell it back home to their members, who after all are the ultimate bosses. And so we've got to keep this at enough arm's length and providing enough services so that each of you can sell it to your members as something that their dues dollars are supporting, and it is enhancing their dues dollars. Any comments or questions on that sort of a profile of an organization? Maybe this is old hat to you and you've been through a number of these, but I want to emphasize those points. Yes? Well, yeah. Yes, I guess that's right. I think that's right. Yeah. Yeah, there's truth in that. I hope we'll be a little more effective than they've been. A lot less debate, a lot more action. Could be. Let's just skip over to the next page. And I've given some assessments here. We've given some assessments of the strengths and weaknesses of the organization. And maybe if we kind of go through those, it'll give me a chance to explain why I see an organization of the type that I have described as being able to deal with this. It seems to us that your group has the advantages that I've listed there, that obviously meat eating is just endemic to American life. The economic impact of animal agriculture in our society is multi-billion and great. The organizations represented here are larger in size and number than the organizations representing the animal rights movement, with one or two exceptions like our friends in Massachusetts. Your organizations are more professionally and better managed than their organizations are. They're still pretty amateur. In most cases, there are a couple of theirs that are very professional. But by and large, they're more they work more from the heart, if you will. And you certainly have more financial clout. And sometimes, not always, but sometimes, you have demonstrated pretty substantial political clout. Their strengths, it seems to us, are that they have more emotional. Yes, too. Oh, no question. No question of that. I think, in fact, that argument is an interesting one because psychologically we are uncertain without some research just how we would come out on that issue, for this reason, that the farm organizations would say, well, we're really concerned about animals. And the animal rights people would say, well, yes, we are too. You know, that's our whole concern. And so the public is kind of there scratching its head. Here are these two groups that are both concerned on the same issue. And, but certainly that is a strength of your groups. Yes, absolutely. That should be added to that list also. You have, a century or more of solid scientific research. And the other group has done, as far as I know, very little or no valid scientific research of their own. Instead, they're using yours and trying to show that it makes their points. They do have some strength, though. Certainly, their emotional appeal is just very hard to deal with. It's tough to fight warm puppies. Their grassroots political strength ought to be pretty strong, because they are activists, and it's pretty easy these days to hook into the network that's out there. And if they can ever find a link with the environmentalists, various religious groups that share their views, consumerists and others, clearly that's a grassroots difficulty. One of the main points is that they are basically an urban group, and we are basically a rural group. And so the struggle, therefore, I think it's reasonably safe to assume without research that the rural community in America is certainly going to be on our side of the issue, if you will. The trouble is, of course, today that everybody lives in the urban community, or the great majorities do, And that's where the battle is going to be fought, and that's where they are. So that's a strength. They are pretty unpredictable, because these questions they're talking about, when you trace them back to their source, are all philosophical or religious questions. And, you know, well, we all know you can't win a religious argument. So that's a strength for them. Because remember, all they want to do is sow doubt. That's all they have to do, is sow enough doubt about the animal agricultural industry that people start saying, well, that might be right, so it won't hurt any then to do a little research, or it won't hurt any then to have a few regulations, because they might be right. Certainly, one thing that usually helps, they have on their side, and that is they can say, hey, there's nothing in this for us, we don't make any money out of it, this is their lifeblood, this is where they make their living, so naturally they're taking the position they do, whereas we're just trying to do right, we're just good citizens trying to straighten out the world, and perhaps most importantly of all, they have absolutely nothing to lose. It's just fun and games for a lot of them. It's this year's activism. Next year they'll be off onto something else, or next decade, or whenever. Now, some others of them, of course, are committed to this and will spend their lives on this issue. But it's a lot of difference when you have nothing to lose.
So it's something diplomatic to avoid that argument, but it's not true. Main society needs to have issues, and need to have people all over the country sending them $10 contributions. They don't have an issue right now. They need to keep their organization alive. They need to have conflict and issues to live. There's a lot in it.
Oh, absolutely.
How do we diplomatically get that kind of problem?
Well, we have found, as a general rule, that that's a very tough issue to raise. And here's particularly for the big guys, and we're the big guys in this one, and they're the little guys. Because when the big guy starts saying that about the little guys, we say, well, the Humane Society, they're just raising this issue because here's their fundraising letter, you see, and they just want people to send them in money and so forth. Immediately you expose yourself to the argument that, well, you know, isn't that how you make your living? Isn't that how your industry makes its bucks? And so it just becomes a shooting match back and forth, and there's not a heck of a lot to be gained by it. There are, however, many things to be gained by the tactics that they may use to raise money. Someone already alluded to that. And by using their own materials against them, without really saying that their interest in this is to raise money for their treasury. People see a fundraising letter, they know a fundraising letter when they see one. In fact, a lot of them say, yeah, I got that one. So there are ways to do it, but we find it very difficult to do head on.
Although it may be nice to have nothing to do, why do you
Well, if you have nothing to lose, it kind of removes you from any kind of accountability, from any sort of worrying about the next day's income. You see, I mean, this is just really a thing they're doing. They don't have to worry about the basic issues of life. Their income, their activities that support them are all over here somewhere. And if they win or lose on this issue, that's over here. It doesn't really matter. So if they lose this year, they can come back next year, and the year after that, and the year after that. It's an avocation with them. And that gives them a sort of a psychological freedom to shoot from the hip and do whatever seems like it might be effective at the moment. Because they're not accountable. Whereas on our side, somebody's got to produce the feed and the meat and so forth for next week's eating, and that's your groups. You know, they're kind of busy doing that stuff. And a slight victory in some area of regulation by the other people could have a real chilling effect on abilities to do that job. And the psychological result of that is that groups whose income, livelihood, method of operation are threatened tend to tighten up a good deal, because you've got something to lose. Whereas for them, it's just, you know, like a night at the movies. It's just something they're doing.
I think there may be a slight difference between the organization. I mean, clearly something like the Massachusetts Humane Society gets involved in this in a big way and loses a lot of money. they may not go for that again, but the strength of these animal rights people is the individual has nothing to lose. I mean, he may have given $10, but they are using volunteer workers on the whole, or people with a cause. I mean, an extreme example, you see the clamshell people. They really had nothing to lose. They had nothing.
They can go get arrested and get hauled out to jail for a week because, you know, most of them didn't have anything else to do that week. And
I think
that's right. And now that's really what we mean here, is that it is an advantage. It's a great psychological advantage. Just think of your own activities. I mean, you know, when you go to your office and you're working, and you're accountable, you ever notice there's a kind of a pressure on it? And boy, you're very careful, and you may clutch up a little bit and be a little more conservative. But when you're out playing golf, you say, oh, what the hell, another sand trap, so what, and away you go, and it's all free and easy. And that's just a better psychology for a group, see?
But the people, not those that are calling the shots, but the people who are out in front doing the work, are beautiful. They're crusaders on the white horse with the shining armor, and they're
right.
Hard to it.
You betcha.
And they say that, like, that's
you betcha.
That's when you got nothing to lose.
That's it. Interesting. We were talking about that yesterday and talking about this business of the wholesome food for everyone. I mean, that's an issue that we can make, which everybody is in tune with, and it would be very hard for the opposition to come out. I couldn't agree with you more. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. That's for sure. Now, maybe more important, however, is the next list, because we feel there's a lot of similarity between the two groups. If you look at the average agriculturist, and you look at the average animal rightist, not maybe the far-out zealots, they're both people who are very independent, self-sufficient kind of folks. I don't have to tell you about independent farmers, and if you don't know any animal rights people, I can guarantee you they're at least as independent. The people who are the stakeholders tend to be really true believers. I mean, let's face it, the average farmer out there is a believer, a true believer in agriculture, in their particular crop or commodity, and the same certainly is true of these other folks. In fact, many of them are zealots. Their coalition, if they can ever put it together, includes a lot of very diverse organizations, very diverse. And there's a lot of diverse organizations around this table. So both sides have to carefully craft a coalition that will hold together. And that is why we feel that that's where the emphasis ought to go. Both sides can make some gut issues. Certainly we can talk about food, and they can talk about warm puppies, and that does tend to grab people. And the last point, F, you may or may not agree with. My perception of the agricultural community as a community holding together on issues is one where you couldn't say that we've always stood side by side and marched. In fact, I think you could say we've more often marched off in our own directions, and that, of course, concerns me. Because of that, and because of the fact that we know there are these differences of opinion in the animal rights movement, we see the ability to get a position across to the public as maybe being at about the same level. This is why we say, I said last time, that it's a group that doesn't shoot itself in the foot that is probably going to be successful. There are seeds for success and seeds for failure in both sides of the issue. And that's the reason that, again, we feel the key is how we set up this organization, how we agree to work together, and the level of commitment that we're willing to make. If that commitment isn't there, then this strategy I'm now talking about ought to be scrapped, and we got to take some other approach to it, because this kind of organization I'm describing won't work without a commitment from the organization. Let's skip on over to the section, the next section here on strategy itself. Because the ultimate activity is going to be setting up the issue strategy. This is largely a review, I think, for those of you who were here last time, of the points we made then, but you've had a chance to think about them. Let's just read through this and see if we're still in any kind of agreement on it, or if we are in any kind of agreement on it. First, we believe that if this becomes a public issue, that it isn't going to be logic or even right or anything like that that's going to be the determinant. It's people's sensibilities, people's perceptions, their emotional approach to the issue. If the animal rights people can emotionally convince lawmakers and the public that these poor, helpless animals are being maltreated, that is going to be effective. It's a winning kind of a position. And that puts us in the position of having to make positive, good treatment of animals an emotional issue much more difficult. Negatives are always easy to stir up and whip up, and they've got the negative and we've got the positive. So facts have nothing to do with most of these issues. In debate or markup on the Hill, facts sometimes are potent. Of course, the basic fact of how people feel back home is the single most potent fact, and if the people back home are emotionally involved, then the facts of the case are not going to make much difference. Secondly, we think this is dangerous because of the philosophic, moral, and religious questions that it raises. You know, you're really getting right down to basics about what is man's place in the universe, the whole question of the food chain. And those are the kind of arguments that are very, very hard to put before the public from our point of view, and relatively easy for them to stir up questions about. Thirdly, we've already talked about this, if we can keep the public involved in how this issue affects them, as someone said earlier, it's meat on the table at a reasonable cost, which is wholesome and healthy, then we've got a strong argument. But that's a somewhat difficult thing to do. The public is confused by economics, and if they are confused by economics in general, they are absolutely bamboozled by agricultural economics. I mean, aren't we all? So how can you expect the public to understand that? So we're going to have to reduce this argument to very simple economic terms. And we're going to have to make some relationships which may upset some of the scholars in our group, because we're going to leave out a few of the little details and routes, because the public doesn't read those details. We're going to have to go A, B, C. That's tough to do, but that's where it's going to be on our side as far as we can see. We don't quite know whether the animal rights people can rise above emotionalism in their arguments. Those are going to be their most potent arguments. But if they can back up their emotional arguments with some harder facts, chemicals in your meat, this whole question of veal or pork production and so forth, that will make them even more potent to deal with. Finally, and this is a tough one, this is why we say strategy should be decided by the group as a whole, we've got to have some fallback or crossover strategies. You can't go into a struggle like this with strategy A, and that's the only strategy you're going to have. So we need to do some research and some planning on fallback strategies in case they should be necessary. And this raises that basic point that it may be necessary to make some compromises somewhere down the line. And once again, you will see why our emphasis is on pulling the organization together and pulling it together tightly, because fallback strategies mean changing what you're doing in the middle of the course. And that's why we think strategy should be something that this whole group decides, not just this new entity. And compromises are very, very touchy debates. And it's that tightness of the organization that's going to enable us to make compromises, should that ever become necessary, and not fall apart as an organization. Absolutely critical. Point five on that page is probably the guts of the issue.
We've already heard, at least I have heard, I think one or two of you say, let's not give them a single victory. Well, am I hearing there's never going to be any compromise or what? It's that kind of thing which will come up fairly soon, I think.
Yes, we would prefer not to give them any, you understand, but if it becomes a reality, one then cannot sit around nursing our disappointment. We have to come up with a compromise and go right back out. Yes.
Came back already to sit down and start working out the compromise.
Oh, I'm sure they would.
You never give away anything till you have to.
Of course not. There's a time to compromise and a time not to. And we hope it'll never come. But if it does, we just want to make the point that we've got to be psychologically ready. And that means a strong organization that can withstand it. Finally, and this is a point that I really, really need all of your attention on. As we look at this issue and possible related issues that may come along in the next 3 or 4 years, it's clear to us that the agricultural community can spend the rest of the century and beyond battling off one issue after another. Or we could use this new entity as a kind of a model of cooperation and positive public education, so that agriculture is well accepted and better understood by the public, and it makes it just that much tougher, maybe even impossible, for these kind of activists to come at us. If you take a look at other institutions in this country which have been attacked by activists, it's very instructive. Some people like to think, well, gee, you know, the activists are a new phenomenon. They just began, and that's why there's all this activism. Forget it. I mean, Americans have been activists, as I said last time, since long before 1776. It's in our blood. And there are always activists. Gosh, in your own industry, look at the teens and the 20s as a time of activism. Up until now, American institutions have generally been able to deal with activists and often to make very necessary and good compromises with them, which benefited both the industry and the activists and the public. But we were able to do that in a position not of being beaten into a corner, but instead of debate and discussion and a healthy strength. In the last 10 or 20 years, various other industries, or higher education, or public education, secondary education, have found themselves with activists that were winning point after point after point. For what reason? The reason that they no longer had that core strength, that unity of position. And the way we see this issue, what's at stake here is not really how strong the animal rights people are or can become. That's not really at stake, because they're going to be out there anyway. What's at stake is whether or not the American agricultural community can agree to debate its internal debates out in the back room a little more privately and to stand tightly together publicly. I don't think, from our experience in this over 20 years and working with a lot of these issues around the country as well as here, I don't think that's an overstatement. In fact, I was reading a book again the other day, a little thin book some of you may have, that it's called, oddly enough, Activist Movements in American Agriculture. It goes back to Shays' Rebellion and takes it on up from there. And it was interesting to me in reading this book how in the past, until maybe the 50s, how American agriculture really did stand together when there were these kind of public issues. And so that's why we feel that this entity, if it can be established and if these principles work, could also be a model for all these other issues that we know are going to come down the pipe. What are your thoughts on that? Yes?
I would say from what you said, the opposition,
amen. That is my sentiment. I think I spent the last time with us together. Remember I said the one who loses is going to be the one that shoots himself in the foot.
I don't know about the word compromise, but to say that there's no room for any discussion with those people or those groups, is to say that everything in our industry is hunky-dory and nothing is changing. And my question is, doesn't that destroy our credibility?
Absolutely. Yeah. And there are things in our industry that may be changing, that may need changing now. You know, I think we have to...
For any discussion.
No, I'm sorry.
Well, compromise implies that if you say that there's no why discuss anything, you're not going to compromise.
Well, I think that what the point I was making was that they may very well find things, arguments, situations that are so potent that we may have to discuss compromise with them. That's what I'm saying. And that we should come into this understanding that we are not perfect. And that we all know that even though the great majority of our producers out there are doing everything we say they are, we'd be less than honest if we said that was 100%. I mean, we know there are some folks out there doing the very things, obviously, that the animal rights people are squawking about, or they wouldn't have some of the examples, some of the horror stories that they've got. No group as large as agriculture is going to be, 100% pure, as it were. And that's what I am saying, is that we've got to organize so tightly that if it's necessary to compromise, but compromise often is in our own best interest. Sometimes it's best to compromise on a point now and win a bigger point or avoid having to fight a bigger point tomorrow. And what we're saying is that the organization has to be so strong that we can debate those compromises and fight like mad over them before we come to a consensus, but that it's all good, healthy, internal debate. It doesn't get people mad and they get up and leave and go off their own way, because that's the danger. And unless you're psychologically prepared to have a fallback position and to make a compromise, the first ill wind that blows away the coalition, in our experience.
I understand what you're saying about being very important that the organization has a great deal of internal strength, and I agree with that, but it seems clear to me that there's any number of farm organizations that are not here and probably will never be members of this coalition. The question in my mind, what are you going to do when some farm group takes issue or takes a different approach than this?
Well, that is always the problem. That's the form of shooting yourself in the foot, isn't it? When someone else who says, well, I'm just as much a farmer as that group over there is, and I say this. I guess that one of the first jobs of this organization ought to be to get out to everybody else that could conceivably have any interest in this and get them either to become active members, sponsors of the coalition, or maybe to set up a second category of those who associate themselves with the positions of the organization, but maybe for some other reason can't become an active sponsor. In fact, I would hope that once this organization is set up as a third party, that we could then go beyond agriculture. And I think we can make a lot of alliances with other kinds of organizations that are interested in this. I see no reason why a lot of the consumer groups might not be interested in supporting this. They may fight with all of you on other issues. So what? I mean, strange bedfellows in politics, those same people, are not going to be very favorable to some of the things that the animal rights people are proposing or what the economic impacts of those would be on the consumer issues. And I think there are dozens of other mainstream kind of organizations that might be willing to cooperate with, join with. But if some big farm organization takes another position, the only thing you can do is just to restate your position. And if it's one organization out there stating a position, and we're a coalition of 40 organizations, obviously one says, well, that's that one organization's position, but the 40 organizations we represent with X million members and so on and so forth say the following. And generally that tends to have the weight.
Do you in fact foresee any possibility? I mean, have some of you got those organizations in your mind that you think might be?
Seems inherent to me. Seems to me it's the history of agriculture. Agricultural associations have disagreed on just about everything you can think of. It seems inherent to me that at some point, some organizations who may not be affiliated with it will take a different position.
Yes, I don't deny that possibility, and I don't really know how to deal with it short of getting the great weight of the agricultural industry into this coalition. I don't think any of us have taken a list of all the agricultural organizations and ticked them off. I think this group was pulled together, wasn't a few from among those that had an interest, that had an organization that was capable at the moment and more or less mainstream. But you're raising a point to which there really is no standard answer other than doing our homework, getting out to those other groups, keeping them informed, even those who are in agriculture that may not be able for some reason to participate in this. Let's keep them informed of what we're doing. Some of you may know groups that will shoot at us. Goes, you know, you get one bad apple and everybody blames the whole bunch.
The PR person wants to hear your reaction to it. I don't know, they recognize them, even though that wasn't their problem. It's not like they had really nothing to do with it. It was an external factor. And the public admitted that it was their problem, and it really wasn't. And the pressure measures, three factors, pressure measures to overcome the problem, and being full share of the market back plus more by doing that. By admitting a problem that they really didn't have, the public would love to support.
Well, let me give you an example. In recent times, we have examples on both sides of that issue. Tylenol is one. The way Procter & Gamble dealt with the Rely product problem. In both cases, what those companies essentially did was just what we're suggesting here. They didn't worry about the facts. They dealt with the emotions and the perceptions of the public. And in both cases, the company said, holy Moses, people are being hurt with our product. Never mind whose fault it is, we've got to solve this problem. And the public said, hey, how about that? Now on the other side, we have Hooker Chemical Company at Love Canal. Factually, Hooker is absolutely 1,000% innocent of any wrongdoing. In fact, at Love Canal, they exceeded the standards of the time for chemical waste. They put a clay cap over it when clay caps were not required. When they found they weren't using the land anymore, they gave it to the local school board for $1, including a lot of usable land around the clay cap area. As part of the deed in which they gave it to the school board, they said, you are never to puncture that clay cap or get within 50 feet of it. I mean, they were the best possible corporate citizens. And boom, we have Love Canal, and the cameras turn on Hooker Chemical, and what do they say? Isn't our fault, they said. And the public said, you bastards. And all they had to say was, holy Moses, never mind whose fault it is, people are losing their homes, and we're going to give $1 million, which they did. They donated $1 million to the cause, nobody even knows it, just because they tried to deal with the facts and not with the public. And that, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's the essence of what we've got here. The public is not going to take time to consider the details of how we raise veal or pigs or you name it. It's going to be an emotional kind of a situation. And that's why it's got to be a tight organization here that can really thoughtfully, based on research and careful professional planning, make those points out there.
One of your problems may be that you probably know where the skeletons are in your cupboard. And one of the tests of this organization is whether, in fact, you can share them with the other members of the group so there are no surprises. Because if there are surprises, what will probably happen is that you will then turn on that one and make them the sacrificial lamb. And
not a good idea.
Which is not a good idea.
The question of education, the question of education of our own members and their practices, those who are not up to speed, is, however, I think, another benefit of this organization. It's tough for you, I know you're working with your own members anyway all the time, to get them up to snuff, but you know, there comes a point when clearly they're not listening. They can't hear you. They say, who are you to tell me what to do? It may be that this third-party entity I'm talking about might be able to deal with those folks, take you off the hook, you see, go to them and say, hey, look, Joe, you know, what you're doing could bring us all down in a heap. And so that's something we probably ought to add as a benefit that this organization might be able to organize.
I think the other pattern you might like to look at, for instance, is the steel industry. As you probably know, the steel industry spent more time or more money fighting clearing up its act than it would have cost to clear it up. So they bought themselves a double negative.
She's talking about the acid rain situation. We have been involved in that situation. And as of 4 years ago, the steel industry literally had spent more money in lawsuits fighting off putting in clean chimneys than it would have cost them to put in the damn clean chimney. I mean, it gets to the point where it isn't sensible anymore. Well, if you, yes, excuse me, please.
I just wanted to make a remark about the compromise and the discussion of this. I think there are many things we don't need to compromise on. We can clearly admit, and by admission, we can remove that and admit
yes.
Now. An important concept along with the government, I think, continues. When they talk in meetings of the activists, they are continuously saying, all animal species are being exploited for the benefit of only one species, and this is improper and not right. And agriculture is doing this. And my reaction is, well, of course agriculture is doing it. That's what agriculture is. Agriculture is the exploitation of plant and animal for the well-being of mankind. And so that's what it's all about. And I think we can freely admit this type of thing. And this is saying this one so frequently and so strongly. You're exploiting these animals. Of course we're exploiting them. That's how humans live. And you go through the whole thing, you can jump from the parasites right on through to the day of exploitation, which is what we're in.
Exactly. No, that's a good point. And that's a way you, that's a psychological strategy for ending the debate on that subject.
Everybody's more concerned with their own well-being, and if you can say that's what we're attempting is to advance the well-being of the community.
Where are you? Yes.
Guidelines along those lines, carry out their duty that they're in their individual organization. That's where they come.
But that is the honest answer. We cannot do it alone. You're talking primarily about a lobbying aspect. And I guess our response to that is that though I know in Washington in particular you see the action on the Hill, and certainly if there's regulation it may come from the Hill, we don't see that as the battlefield for this issue. Because ultimately this is an issue that is going to be decided by the public. Because it's too critical. It's not just a little technical issue. This is an issue that goes to the heart of everybody's favorite subject, you know, the food supply.
I think we're talking about forming an organization not to take the issue to Capitol Hill, to take it to the American people.
Right. Right. It's clear from your comments that I did not then explain accurately how I saw this organization and what I was describing. So let me go back over that. Because exactly what we do not see is an organization that is set up, as you say, as a big operation, as a big conglomerate. I was describing a coordinating organization which would not do a lot of the actual activities that you are mentioning. I talked about coordinating what is happening in state legislatures and on the Hill. I talked about getting educational materials together in a coordinated way that everybody here could use with their members and to educate the farm community, the agricultural community, about this issue. I talked about surveillance, which ought to obviously be done in a coordinated way rather than each group doing their own, which is a duplication. And this doesn't mean that the surveillance for budget reasons might in fact have to be divided up. I think a lot of the work might have to be divided up where each of you would provide your sector and it would be coordinated with somebody else. So that what we're talking about is an organization that can concentrate on this issue, whereas each of you has a lot of other things to do. And you remember I said that the key to it, I thought, was your ability to sell back home to your members the fact that the existence of this organization and your participation in it was a benefit to them. So I want to, if anybody else feels that I'm describing some kind of a mega organization that's going to conduct a lot of programs, a lot of activities, the things that we're talking about primarily are coordinating things. However, a coordinating organization, if it always just has to call on a member, is in a very weak position. So we do have to have these abilities to, for example, I spoke about the possibility of a hotline response for someone who's in trouble. Someone's got to coordinate that kind of information. And it may be some of you might want simply to be able to refer a troubled member to this organization rather than handling that yourself. Others may wish to handle it themselves, in which case the coordinating organization's role would be to see that any materials it develops, which it might give directly to callers, were also available to each of you in case you'd rather handle those yourself. But we certainly don't see this as it's not an activist go out there organization. Remember I said it's a quieter, educational kind of a thing for the long haul.
It's interesting that when we were discussing it, one of the things that we specifically said, and we probably should have said it earlier to you,